yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did you? I say there ain't nobody. I say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow, now is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast with host Eddie Trunk.
Hey everybody, it's Eddie Trunk and welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Interviews with your favorite names in rock and metal. New episodes every Thursday. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and thank you for checking it out. As I tell you every week, everything you hear on the podcast as far as the interviews all originated on my Sirius XM radio show, Trunk Nation, which is heard live Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Faction Talk, Sirius XM channel 103. If you only listen to this podcast and you can get Sirius or XM or subscribe to it, you're only getting a tiny fraction of what I do on the radio live every day. So please come on board and join me for Trunk Nation talking rock with you Monday through Friday. Again, 3 to 5 Eastern time. And if that time doesn't work for you, you can always listen anytime you want on demand on the Sirius XM app. So be sure to join me on Sirius XM radio if you can, if you are in the U.S. or Canada. We have a great interview for you this week that took place. I did this about, I guess when you're hearing this, about 2.5 weeks ago. And it was done at an event that I co-host called The Sands in Cancun at the Planet Hollywood Resort. And one of the artists that performed at the event was legendary foreigner vocalist Lou Gramm, the guy who, such a huge part of the band, such an incredible voice, sang on all the legendary classic material. Lou, who I was super psyched to have come on, ended up joining me and sitting in with me for probably over an hour or just about an hour, and got real candid about his entire history in music, his feelings about Foreigner, some great stories about recording some of the Foreigner classics. You're going to love this. It was a real, real treat to have him on. Can't wait for you to have a listen to it right now. Lou Gramm on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. He is one of my all-time favorite singers, one of the greats of all time, and I am so honored that he's taken some time out from the beautiful weather out there and the pools and the beaches to sit in here with me and yap for a bit. Lou Gramm is here. Good to see you, Lou.
Good to see you, Eddie.
How you doing, man? How you
doing? Well.
Yeah?
Doing very well.
You look great. How's your health?
My health is good. I'm being a good boy. And I'm enjoying life.
What is constitute being a good boy for Lou Gramm? When you were a bad boy, what were you doing?
Same thing all the bad boys were doing. Yeah. You know? And at some point, I made the decision that I had had enough of it, and took measures to straighten myself out and live right.
How difficult was that for you to do, coming up in the 70s, a big successful rock band, all the trappings of the excess and all that? How difficult was it for you to get right?
It was difficult, and there was a little red character with horns who sat on my shoulder that did not want me to get right. I needed to, because I was jeopardizing my marriage, and I didn't want my kids to know me as this alter ego that I would become, you know, when I was in excess.
Mm.
So I'd had enough of that anyways, you know, Foreigner toured for long amounts of time when we were on the road, and at some point we partied hardy and often and I honestly got tired of life that way, and I took steps Well, first of all, I became born again.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Hazleton. And this happened right after Foreigners, the original band, Foreigners, last show at Madison Square Garden.
What year are we talking about?
Talking about 92.
So when you, because you had left the band for a couple of years and then you came back.
Yes.
So it was then. Yes. And you guys played the Garden. And yes, then that was the height of where you felt you were having a problem.
It was, you know, at any rate.
And Hazleton is a rehab facility?
It's in northern Minnesota.
Okay.
And after the Garden, all the record company execs were there, and all our friends in other rock bands, and it was a wonderful time. But at some point, I knew that I was off the tracks, and when I got back to my hotel, I knew I was not going to make my flight the next day. Next early morning, I was flying back to Rochester, and I knew that I was going to get little to no sleep, and I was not going to make that flight. So when I did get up the next day, I called my attorney, and he's also a very good friend of mine at the time, and told him my situation and asked him if he knew of a place that I could rehab and turn my life around. And he suggested Hazleton. And so I called my wife and let her know I was not coming home and that I was going to take care of a long-standing problem. And she knew exactly what I meant, and she told me, go get it.
How long were you there for, Lou?
A month.
A month. And obviously, did that month set you right from that point on, or were there relapses and you had to go back? Because you hear a lot about that with people who go through relapse.
I'd been to a few other places before, but they were 2 week stints, and they were holistic, and it kind of set you where you think you ought to go, but Hazleton really was like a boot camp.
Because you hear those stories of so many musicians or actors or whatever going to rehab, and they were bringing in drugs in the back room while they were in there, and they were partying and everything. You were committed to it. You weren't messing around.
I wasn't messing around, and there were some characters in my. It was like a it was like a boot camp, and they had different halls or different almost like fraternities, little groups of guys, like 16 guys, and then another group of 16 guys, then another group of 18 or 20 women and stuff like that. Everybody was separated into little camps, you know. Mm-hmm. So the guys that I was in camp, and one guy was a Northwest Airlines pilot.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
You don't want a pilot being high flying a plane.
He told us stories that were unbelievable.
Wow.
And also a mobster, a New York City mobster.
Oh, wow.
Went there to straighten out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a collection of really different people.
I was going to say, I don't think that airline is still going anymore. That might be the reason why.
You know what? It's too bad. It was a great airline.
I never flew it, but it's like, you know, I mean, it's, you know, God forbid something happens on the plane, but you know what I'm saying? That's crazy. If you don't mind me asking, without being too personal, you said you would turn and it was jeopardizing your relationship and everything. What was your biggest issue? Was it drugs, alcohol, or both?
It was both.
Both.
It was both.
You didn't discriminate.
It was drugs more than alcohol, but alcohol was right up there.
And when you're talking about drugs, hard drugs or, you know, cocaine.
Cocaine.
Mainly. You weren't injecting stuff.
No. Nope.
Okay. But that was enough to set you off, and credit, you realized you needed help, and that's probably why you're still sitting here right now.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, there started to be a lot of us rock and rollers that were dropping.
Yeah.
you know, from overdoses and accumulated use. And I did not want to be that statistic.
You know, I was just talking to some friends about of mine about, I just saw Aerosmith play recently, mm-hmm. and their residency in Vegas was pushed back a month because Steven had to go to rehab again. And he was very open about it and talked about it. And he had had some surgery done on his feet, and they gave him painkillers, and he got hooked on them. And he immediately recognized it and got into rehab. And he's 75, and he's still amazing at what he can do. And I said to my friends, I said, you know what? Credit to him for realizing yes. how quickly he needed help, because a guy with that much wear on the tread from the years and decades of doing that, he wouldn't endure it at 75 more than a few days, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's, well.
You got to know yourself at that age. Boy.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to ask you, you had an issue with your health where you had brain surgery, right?
Yes, I did.
And do you think, or did doctors tell you your issues with that were at all in any way due to your addictions or no?
I thought for sure that it was. Mm-hmm. But when after the MRIs were taken and I spoke to the doctor that was going to operate on me, he says don't even think that. He says you were born with this tumor.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't cancerous, right?
It was not cancerous, but it finally got big enough to be an issue in your life.
And how was it manifesting yourself? Did you feel pain? Were you getting headaches?
I was getting headaches. I was suffering from spotty long and short term memory lapses. I go to call my parents, and halfway through dialing the number, I couldn't remember the last four numbers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and you know, little things like that, but stuff that, I mean, it bothered the hell out of me, you know? And I'd be getting fits of dizziness, and, you know, I had about three MRIs in three different places, and each doctor told me to go home and put my affairs together.
Oh, my gosh.
Yep. And so I was home and I was putting my affairs together, and I happened to see on 2020, the program 2020, a segment about a doctor in Boston. His name was Dr. Black, and he was the purveyor of operating on inoperable brain tumors using laser surgery. And so After the segment on TV, I called his office early the next morning and told his personal secretary about my situation. And she says, hang on a second. She goes, and so this was Tuesday morning. And she goes, we have an opening on Thursday. Can you get here tomorrow? So I flew there the next day, and they did more MRIs on me. And at 5 in the morning, Thursday morning, they were wheeling me into the operating room.
Now, what year was this?
This was 1999. No, sorry, 1997.
So 25 years ago. And so is that procedure that you had in that sort of surgery become more of the norm now, do you know?
Yes, it is.
It is. So you were one of the first or earliest to have it.
Yes, I was.
What was that recovery like for you?
It was about 8 years.
Wow.
8 years till I consider myself fully recovered. So the surgery took 19 hours, and when the doctor came in to see me, I slept a full day and a half after the surgery. When he finally came in to see me and we talked for a while, he told me how difficult the surgery was, and he says, you've got another battle to fight. He goes, your recovery is going to be long and intense. He says, just deal with it. He says, you'll be feeling better and better slowly, and at some point you'll be back to 100%. And sure enough, you know, I was so pleased that tumor was removed from me, but I immediately developed sleep apnea. You know, I couldn't get to sleep at night. I'd be waking up in the middle of the night in cold sweats.
Well, sleep apnea is when you don't get enough oxygen when you sleep.
That's right.
And that was a byproduct of, because that can be for a few different reasons. It could be because you weigh too much. I had it for 10 years. and I lost some weight and it went away. But it's not a big rumor about that is it's exclusive to being heavy. It's not. Right. I have friends that weigh 100 pounds and have it. So right. You can have it for a variety of reasons. But you had it because of the surgery.
Yes.
Wow.
But I was on massive steroids after the surgery for about 10 years. I mean, massive steroids.
So it may have blown up your larynx or something.
Well, it blew up a number of things. I gained about 150 pounds.
You were that heavy.
My weight as an adult was 145 pounds.
So you were almost at 300?
Yep, 290 pounds I was.
Were you ever seen like that? I don't recall seeing
pictures.
I
was on stage like that.
Were you really?
Yep.
I don't recall seeing you like
that.
Oh,
yeah. I'd be hearing shouts from people in the audience going, better lay off the pasta and sauce, or better skip those burgers or something. You know, people can be pretty cruel.
Of course, yeah. You know?
And
it was your medication.
It was my medication. And how about this? When I went in for surgery, we had to cancel the Far East, Japan, Australia, a whole Far Eastern swing of touring with Foreigner. And my surgeon told me, I had a drag race car myself too. I'm a car fanatic, and he told me not to drive that car anymore for a long time. And he said, I don't want you touring with the band. He says, for at least a year. And 2 months after I got out of surgery, I was on the road.
With Foreigner?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Because when they postponed the shows that I was supposed to play when I went in for surgery, mm-hmm. they rescheduled them for 3 or 4 months later. You know, they should have waited until they
sure.
got my prognosis.
Right.
But they rescheduled them without waiting, and I was told that the band would be under massive lawsuits if we didn't perform the shows the second time, at least, you know.
And how did you do on those shows?
Let me tell you something. I had to have some of the lyrics to every song written down on a white piece of paper with a big black marker and taped to the floor.
So basically not a teleprompter, handwritten out.
Handwritten out, yeah. And it wasn't the whole verse. If I could remember the first two or three words, the rest of the verse would come to me. But as the music's leading up to the verse, I would blank out. And that's the way I performed with the band for about a year.
Wow. Unbelievable. I mean, I don't want to spend this whole time talking about your health. I want to talk about music, of course.
Sure.
But last thing that I want to ask you about...
It was hell, let me tell you.
I would imagine. But the last thing I want to ask you about health-wise, I mean, again, I'm not just saying this to be nice. You look great. Is all of this behind you now? Do you have to still go through anything to checks in your head and all of that?
Every 2 years, I have an MRI to make sure nothing new is returning. And so far, it's been 100% clean.
Great. And how do you feel now vocally?
I'm up to par on what I was 20 years ago.
Is that right?
I swear to you.
So you feel like you can sing it all right now? No,
I do.
You do? Well, I'm going to see you tonight. I can't wait.
Good.
I can't. It's been too long since I saw you sing. Lou, during the commercial break, you just told me something that blew my mind. You are 72. You just talked about all you've been through. And you now have a five-year-old daughter.
Five-year-old daughter, a little redhead.
Oh my gosh.
With blue eyes.
And your oldest child is how old?
42.
So you have a 42 and a five-year-old.
Yes.
How is that to be 72 with a five-year-old?
It's awesome. I mean, she's the sweetest little girl. She loves me so much. I love her. We play hide and seek. We bounce the ball around outside. We do a lot of things, you know, and whenever I can, I take her to the playground, and it's very sweet to you know, when my other kids were that age, I was on the road for months at a time. I mean, months at a time. I missed all of that with them, you know. And to have that with a sweet little girl that I love, again, makes me feel like a kid.
That is awesome. How much are you on the road now?
Not much. We don't do full on tours. We go out for single or double dates.
Weekend fly date stuff.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we could be doing one show or three shows a week, and then we're back home.
So before we talk about some stuff from the past, what you're doing now and what you're doing here is under the name Lou Graham All-Stars, right?
Yes, that's right.
So explain to people what that show is. I imagine it's foreigner stuff, but then other things from out through your career as well?
Yeah, it's foreigner stuff. It's things from my solo albums. It's I think we do a song from Shadow King, and we're starting to prepare some songs from a forthcoming album.
So you're going to do a new record?
Yes.
I'm curious. You know, I've always said you're one of my favorite singers. You're one of the great singers of all time, in my opinion. I truly feel that. When did you first know you could sing? I know you had a band before Foreigner called Black Sheep.
That's correct.
You did two records with them, right?
On Capitol Records, yeah.
It didn't happen, though, right? That band didn't get over the hump.
It was happening. We were set to open the Kiss tour.
What year are we talking?
1976.
Okay. Okay. Well, so when Kiss was really popping.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we played a show at Boston, not the Boston Gardens, but Boston, I can't remember what the name of the place was, but it was a nice size arena. And we opened for, it was their first show of their tour, and we were set to open for them. I think Kiss was on Capitol Records too, weren't they?
Polygram? Well, at that time, Casablanca.
Okay.
Before Polygram bought it.
Okay. At any rate,
were you guys on Capitol or Chrysalis?
We were on Chrysalis, and we recorded a single and a B-side, and it was our understanding that they told us that they were just about to make their inroads into the States. Because they were a European label.
Right.
All right. They told us they were about to make their inroads into the States. They were going to have a big offices in New York and L.A. and so on and so forth. And by the time the album came out, they would give us the full push. Well, after we did the single and stuff, we were waiting and waiting and waiting. And then they finally told us that they decided they weren't going to come to the States.
Mm.
And we asked for our release.
And then you moved to Capitol.
And then we moved to Capitol. Capitol heard us. We played. Matter of fact, we opened for Aerosmith in Syracuse. And there were some Capitol reps there, and they saw us.
Now, you said you were supposed to do the Kiss tour. Why didn't you?
Because at the night of that big show in Boston, which we finished our set and got a standing ovation. And we asked Kiss's tour manager if we could answer our ovation, and apparently they never let an opening act do that.
Do an encore.
And right. he says go answer it, you know. So we went out and we did one more song, and we got another ovation, and we just thanked the audience and went off stage, and we got ready. We went out and watched Kiss, and they were awesome. So this was Christmas Eve, 1975, and on the way home there was a unbelievable snowstorm with sleet and snow, and I made it home with the guys in the band, and about 4:30 in the morning I got a call from our crew guy that our truck with all our equipment in it hit a patch of ice on the New York State Thruway and slid off the road and rolled over.
Mm.
And the guys were all bumped and bruised up, but nobody hurt badly. And that the truck had been winched back on the road and brought to a gas station somewhere in Schenectady. So about 4:30 in the morning, I took the car and Bruce Turgeon, the bass player, and I went and picked up the rest of the crew. And we tried to assess the damages of the equipment, but the box on the truck was like this. and we couldn't get the back door open. So the day after Christmas, we went back there and got somebody to snap the cables on the overhead door, and we managed to get it up enough to see the equipment. And it was 80% destroyed.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And the 28th of December, we were supposed to be in Miami opening for KISS. So we were all young. And we were begging our parents to front us a little money so we can put some kind of equipment and a small truck together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a recession in America then. And nobody's parents in the band could conceivably do that for us. And then we asked Capitol Records if they would do that for us, since we were promoting the album and they were our label, if they could, you know, what would it be for them to front us $25,000 to get equipment and a small truck to
tour support, especially you're about to go out on a band that's blowing up with KISS.
Yes.
Yeah.
They wouldn't do it. And so KISS had no choice but to drop us from the tour. And 2 days later, Atlantic or Capitol dropped us from the label.
So is from there, do you go to Foreigner?
From there, Black Sheep was meeting every 2 or 3 days to try and figure out what we were going to do. We all had part-time jobs and stuff, if we can get some small Fender amps and start playing clubs around Rochester again, you know. And no one was thrilled about that, but we were resigned to doing it. And then when we were at one of our meetings, my dad calls me and said that this guy named Mick Jones called, wants me to call him back. So I got his number and I called him back.
Did you know who he was?
I knew who he was because Black Sheep's manager was an A&M records rep. And Mick was on Spooky Tooth. He was a member of Spooky Tooth.
Right. That's why I asked if you knew, because he had history as well.
Yeah, his band was on A&M records.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So they came and they played, Spooky Tooth played the Auditorium Theater earlier in the year, and Black Sheep's manager, the A&M rep, took the whole band to see them play, and they were great. And then we got to meet them afterwards in the dressing room. I took the two Black Sheep albums with me, mm-hmm. and after meeting him, gave them to him and said, he might enjoy these. This is what we do, you know. And so when he called my dad, and when I finally called him back, he says, I heard the albums. He says, I really like the way you sing. He says, I'm not in Spooky Tooth anymore. I'm putting together my own band. He says, would you like to come and audition for the band? And I paused and I said, you know, I says, we had a terrible run of bad luck in Black Sheep. We lost our truck and most of our equipment in an accident in a snowstorm. I said, we really believe in what we're doing. I says, and I appreciate the offer, but I'd like to see my band through. Maybe we can get back on our feet and resume what we were doing. He says, I understand that. He says, I understand that reasoning. He says, you know what? He says, I'll call you back in a month or 6 weeks and see how you're doing. I says, okay, thanks, Mick. So I went and told the guys in Black Sheep about the call and that he wanted me to come and audition. And they said to me, so what did you say? I said, I told him no. And they says, what are you, out of your mind? the guy said, look, we like these little meetings about how we're going to play clubs and all that stuff, but for all intents and purposes, this band is over. He says, you got a golden opportunity there. You better call him back and take it. So I did call him back and he sent me a ticket to New York, and I was picked up at the airport. I had a gym bag with a couple pairs of socks, a couple pairs of underwear, and a couple t-shirts with me. So the audition was not a traditional audition. We went to a recording studio where they had already recorded some tracks to Feels Like the First Time, At War with the World, a couple songs like that, and so we listened to them a couple times, and Mick was singing me the basic melody, of it. You know.
So those songs were fully written?
Those songs were fully written, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sang me the melody, and I had the lyrics written out. And I went in the recording studio and did about three or four takes because it was a little strange getting comfortable with it for a while. And by the end of the day, they told me that they really liked the singing and the work I did on the songs. And Mick asked me if I wanted to come home and have dinner with him. So I went home and had dinner, and we started working on more songs right then. Matter of fact, we started working on Long, Long Way From Home.
Was that the first song you and he wrote together?
Yes.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yep.
And how quickly does that come together? Like that night?
Yes. Most of it came together that night. And it pretty much continued like that. And we Bud Prager, our manager, had an office on 47th and Broadway. And it was, he was on, I think, the 12th floor, and there were offices all the way around, and the part in the middle was a storage room, which Mick had made into a little practice room.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we practiced.
Wow.
The songs that Mick and I were writing, and Ian had input, and, you know, and Al and stuff, and then we would rehearse the song in our practice room. And when we had about five or six songs done, we had Bud Prager start calling record companies to come and listen to us. You know, we were trying to garner our recording contract. Well, first of all, let me backtrack just a little bit. So this went on for 2 or 3 weeks, and I told the guys, look, I've got to leave. I says I don't have enough clothes
or money to stay
here that long.
You didn't know you're making a record. You didn't know you were in the band yet.
so come to find out, Bud Prager started giving me, as he gave the other band members, $150 a week to live on. Which if you were careful, you could do back in those days.
Yeah, it's tough in New York, but even then, different times.
Ian McDonald lived in New York. Ed Gagliardi lived in Long Island. Dennis Elliott lived in Ossining. And when I moved there, I lived in Katona, New York, in Westchester County. It was close to Dennis. And so you know, it was about an hour drive in and out of the city every time we went in and went out, you know?
Yeah.
So anyways, we worked real hard we had most all the big labels come in and listen to us. And, well, first of all, we did some demos to have them listen to garner their interest to come in and hear us live. Mm-hmm. And they all liked us, but they all passed. And even Atlantic Records passed.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And John Kolodna, do you know who John is?
Sure.
Yeah, he was there with I'm trying to think.
Kolodna started Atlantic and then went to Geffen and Epic and all these other labels, but he was a young guy at Atlantic.
He didn't start Atlantic. It was Ahmet Erdogan that started Atlantic.
No, he said started at.
Yeah, yes,
not
he
started.
Did.
Yeah,
yes,
started at.
Yes,
right.
He did.
Yeah, yeah.
And at any rate, after Atlantic turned us down, he came back on his own and said, he goes, you know what? He says, the songs are great. He goes, but whether it's on a demo or whether you're playing them live, they don't have to be 4 minutes. He says, nobody listens to a 4 minute song on the radio. He says, live, you could stretch it out as far as you want, but when you're listening to a song for the first time, 4 minutes seems like 10 minutes. He says, that's why all the songs on the radio you hear on hit radio are no longer than three and a half minutes. long. And he's true. All those Beatle hits were under 3 minutes.
Right.
You know? So he says, I would like to work with you on trimming the excess from all those songs that you played for us. He said, so we worked on the songs, you know, the solos were 2 minutes in themselves. They were trimmed down to about 20 seconds. And the out choruses where they repeat the chorus over and over again, that was about a half a minute.
Fade it down earlier,
yeah.
Right.
And the beginning, it went around two or three times before the vocals came in. One time, and then the vocals come in. So we edited out all the excess, and then we had the president of Atlantic come back, and the execs come back, and we played those same songs, only they were more concise, and the excitement was higher, and they talked to Bud Prager about a contract for us that day.
And you end up signing to Atlantic, and this is a statistic that when I was doing a little homework here, knowing you were going to come on, that blew my mind, which I did not realize. The first 8 singles that Foreigner released all went top 20.
That's true.
Something that, like...
The Beatles.
The Beatles are the only other band to have that happen,
so, yes.
Right?
Yes.
As a young band at that time... is there anything that can prepare you? We talked earlier, for people just joining us, about some of the bad roads you went down and the excesses that came with this. I imagine there's nothing that can prepare you for out-of-the-box success like that.
No, it was stunning. There's really not a lot of words to describe it. We were extremely proud, but we were working hard too, believe me.
Yeah, no, I bet. Do you have a favorite Foreigner album?
4.
Okay, so that's interesting because that's the record you did with Mutt Lang.
Correct.
Mutt Lang, known for being a taskmaster in the studio and is particularly hard on singers and pulling vocals from singers.
I've got a story.
I'd love to hear it because he himself is a singer who sings on records. I don't know if he sang on 4.
He did.
He did.
Yes.
But what was your experience like? He's like, you know... Mutt Lang's like, it's like a unicorn. Nobody ever really sees him. It's like, you know, this reclusive guy. But you obviously had a positive experience with Mutt, considering it's your favorite record, or maybe not, but the material was so good. So tell me.
So we're working on Jukebox Hero.
Yeah.
Okay. And all the other guys had gone home. It's Mick, Mutt, and me. Okay.
And where is this? Where were you recording?
This was in Electric Lady.
In New York?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And so we had the drum track done. And so the drum track's coming out of the speakers into the live room. And Mutt plays bass. He's an excellent bass player. So he was on bass, and Mick was on guitar. And I was in front of a microphone. And so we started playing the beginning of the song, and I came in with "Standing in the Rain," but you know, stuff like that, and then a beat up 6 string, you know, and Mutt says, "Can we stop?" I says, "Yeah." He goes, "You know," he says, "we've worked on this song for a while." He goes, "And it's awesome when the chorus comes in and all that stuff, and the end of the song is just screaming." He goes, "Why does it have to be so held back at the beginning? Why can't it be bada beat up 6 string?" I says, "Mutt," I said, "you know," and he's singing some of the words to the beginning of the verse in his screamy voice, you know. I'm saying, Mutt, I says, "With all due respect," I says, "this is an AC/DC. I says, this song starts out held back for a reason. So when the hammer comes down, you know it.
Because when that kicks in, Jukebox Hero, the big part, it sets the stage.
I says, "I love AC/DC, but they don't hold anything back from the beginning of the song. And by the end of the song, there's no place left to go."
Right.
And he didn't like that.
Did you guys butt heads over it?
No.
But you ended up, must end up getting your way because the song does build.
That's correct.
Because that's one of the beautiful things. I mean, that's one of the most impactful things about Jukebox here, beyond that it's a great song. It's that build. It's the
dynamics.
Yeah. I mean, Tony Iommi told me that once. He said to me, he goes, you know, the reason why people think Black Sabbath is so heavy is because they don't talk about the parts where it's soft. He goes, you've got to have that yin and yang.
Light
because
and
when
and
you
change.
Get heavy, it magnifies it.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
And when I said that, he didn't say anything, but he didn't say anything more about the way the song is being structured either.
And that was the only record that he did with Foreigner, right?
That's correct.
Is there a reason why, do you think?
He made us wait because he was doing, I think he was doing AC/DC. He was finishing up AC/DC and they got bogged down. So it took him longer to finish their album, and we sat waiting, not recording, with no producer.
Mm.
So then he finally came, and we got to work, and producing our records is not a whirlwind thing. It went on and on, because he's a perfectionist too, you know.
Right.
And at the end, we finally got all the songs the way we wanted them, and he told us that he had another project that he had. I'm trying to think who it was.
Def Leppard, maybe.
I think it was Def Leppard.
Yeah.
That he had to go to, that they were waiting, and he'd love to do the mixing and all that stuff, but he had to leave. And he'd be in touch. He'd be listening to the mixes as we sent them to him.
So he didn't mix for?
No.
Wow, I didn't know that. Who did?
Mick.
Mick did.
And Frank Filippetti, the engineer.
I'm surprised, because that might be the only time I've heard where Mutt didn't complete even mix. So he only produced.
I think he did mix a couple songs, and then he just had to leave.
Did he work you hard as a singer?
Yes.
As part of pulling vocals from you?
Absolutely. But yeah. I didn't mind. I was up to the task.
Did you have to redo things over and over again? Was it a
yes.
lot of that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of it.
Yeah, yeah. I bet. There's some people that can't tolerate that, though. It's just like, what's wrong with that take?
Yeah, no, I felt that way, too, you know, and I would bitch about it, too, you know. I just didn't understand his reasoning on a lot of it, that even Mick and if there were other guys in the room, he would say, you got to do that one again. There's just something. There's something about it. I says, is it out of tune? No, it's not out of tune. I says, is it the dynamic? He says, no, it's not that. There's just something about it. Can you do it again? And you know, I'm okay. But when there's no rhyme or reason, you know,
right.
Other than to make me do it again.
I know. I did and still do occasionally TV, and I used to be a VJ on VH1 Classic, and I used to have a producer that they wouldn't give me a teleprompter, and I would do a rundown of whatever video was coming up, and I would do it fine
from memory,
which I'm not good at, but I wanted to get it done, and he'd be like, give me another one.
Why didn't you have a teleprompter?
They didn't want to pay for it.
This is VH1?
Classic, the baby channel back then.
Okay.
And I'm like, and they felt it would be more natural. I'm like, more natural? I got smoke coming out of my ears trying to remember these lines. What are you talking about? But I do it. Anyway, let's just do one more. I'm like, easy for you to say. Get the one more.
Right,
you know?
Right.
That was the thing. So I can imagine on a singer, like, give me the 20th take of saying Jukebox Hero. You were like, well, get the fuck out of here at some point. Your guy Bob has given me the sign you got to go in 5 minutes. So
okay.
I'm just gonna hit you with some real quick things here,
sure.
And then I'm gonna let you get out of here. 2013 Songwriters Hall of Fame, rightfully inducted into that with Mick. I am out of my mind about Foreigner not being included even for consideration in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I am a voter. I do every year. I scream about it on the radio. Your band, Foreigner, is my top one or two snubs and has been for a while. And I won't give up until it's made right. Are you bothered by it like us, the fans, are?
Yes, I'm bothered by it, but I understand it more. It's at this point, it's less about the music. It's political and it's personal.
You believe that towards you or overall? Towards your band or overall?
Towards my band, for sure. I know it is.
Okay. Well, yeah, I believe Jan Wenner said about that,
yes,
too, in a recent podcast.
Yes. I don't know what he said, but I know the story.
Well, he said something about bands like Foreigner, Styx, REO, Boston, we've not even had conversations about them. Put you guys all in that bucket.
There were conversations, all right, I'll tell you.
You essentially feel like you're being blacklisted from.
Yes, absolutely, we are.
From something specific you did or they did, or
I think when the artists in our time period and not in our ilk, but the artists that were successful around the same time we were, the ones that made it into the Hall of Fame, and we were kind of left behind. Okay, it was very noticeable that we were. And I think Foreigner's manager and Mick went in to see Jan personally. And Mick and Jan were very, very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
They used to go running together. They'd have meals together. They'd see each other socially. They're very good friends. And so they saw Jan in his office and... They wanted a legitimate reason why Foreigner hadn't been inducted like all their peers, you know. And I don't know why, but it led to tempers getting hot.
Mm.
And people losing their tempers. And when Mick and Foreigner's manager left, I think Jan was screaming out the door behind him, "It'll be a cold day in hell when Foreigner gets in the hole."
Well, let's see. Let's get that fixed. And I'm not going to give up pounding away on it because it's insane. Last thing, and I'll let you get out of here. You got up with Foreigner not too long ago, did some songs a few years back. What are your thoughts on Foreigner now? What are your thoughts on Kelly Hansen when you hear him sing the old stuff? And you had said to me last time I talked to you, you could never tour at the level that they tour now. So it's not like you have this desire to be back in there because you can't work like that. Mick barely plays the shows, essentially meaning that nobody on that stage most of the nights had anything to do with those records that were
made. No, there's no original Foreigner in there.
Right, unless Mick shows up for a few songs.
Yeah, and it is a few songs. It might be one or two songs at the end of the night.
Right. So what is your take on this? Do you think they should end? Do you think it's the type of thing that will be going after you and Mick are both gone?
I think so. I don't.
You think it will keep going?
I wouldn't be surprised. It's still a moneymaker. There's another generation of kids that don't know that it's not the original Foreigner, I believe.
Oh, I believe that too. I believe there's a lot of people that don't, that they'll walk into a theater or a casino, see the name, not just with Foreigner, but a lot of bands. What is your take on Kelly as a singer singing your stuff?
I think he's a good singer, and he sings those songs okay. He sings them good, but he mimics my style right down to the ad libs. And I'm offended by that.
Have you talked to him about it?
No, never.
But you were on stage with him, right?
I was on stage with
right.
him, yes.
Yeah.
I just think that if he's going to sing the songs, he could sing the melodies that are familiar. But when it comes to the ad-libs and all the little things that set me aside as a vocalist when I sang them, he should make his own up. He should have his own ad-libs that are his own. He doesn't have to mimic me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lou, I could talk to you forever. I can't thank you enough for the time and doing this. I can't wait to see you sing tonight. I can't wait to hear you.
Oh, we're gonna have a lot of fun tonight.
And you got, you know, I didn't even get to touch on Ready or Not and Midnight Blue and the amazing success you had then as a solo artist.
We'll talk again.
We'll have to do another round. I'd love to break down some of the other records and all that. Shadow King, which you mentioned earlier, great record.
It sure was.
Bruce Turgeon, Vivian Campbell was in that
too, right?
I mean, man, people forget about that. That was
It was a great album.
It was a great album.
You know what? It was an Atlantic Records album, and Mick was still trying to get me back in the band at that point. And Atlantic Records did not push that album at all. It wasn't in the stores. It wasn't promoted. And it was to try and... It was actually supposed to fail so that I would come back to Foreigner.
That's a whole nother story for another time. But again, I know you got to go, and I can't wait to see you play tonight. Thank you again for doing this.
My pleasure.
We hope to do another round, and anything you need to get the word out, you know where to get me. It's an honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Lou Gramm, everybody, just unbelievable. One of the greats. Big thanks to Lou Gramm. Really a big treat for me to have him on the show. And we'll do more with Lou because he's got a record coming, and look forward to catching up with him more when that comes out. I could have talked to that guy for hours. Just great stuff in that. I really hope you enjoyed it. And again, that happened on my Sirius XM radio show live about 2.5-3 weeks ago from Cancun, Mexico, from the Sands event. Please join me every day talking rock with you and doing newsmaking interviews on Trunk Nation Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 Eastern, live on Faction Talk. That's Sirius XM channel 103. And you can, of course, listen to full shows, interviews, audio, video, anytime you want on the Sirius XM app. Be sure to follow me on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook page, at Eddie Trunk. And be sure to listen to the podcast every Thursday for the new episodes. And be sure to subscribe. I'll be back next week with another. Have a good week, everybody.